Hello, welcome to the Gab and Jules show. I mean, Gab is not there, he's still on holiday, so look who's here. Nader Manua is with us. Nader, what a weekend. I mean, we had obviously the start of La Liga and Serie A, plus the Premier League, which was pretty fantastic from start to finish between Arsenal, United, City and Haaland. Liverpool are playing tonight, just after we record this. But the big game really was Chelsea against Spurs, Stamford Bridge, the Battle of the Bridge 2.
Yes.
That's how we called it. First of all, what a game it was, really, from start to finish.
It was very, very good. And to be honest, for me, I was thrown off because I, like many people, think like Spurs are the real deal this season.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, oh, they're going to go to the Bridge, are they going to put on a performance, put on a show? But then very quickly realised that's not the type of game it was going to be.
Yeah.
I think the way it ended showed that they do have something about them. But for that style of play and all that, I think it's probably surprised a few people, but it was a great game. And, you know, it's a great game for a neutral because you can see a lot of frustrated faces at Stamford Bridge. You can say that, couldn't you?
Definitely. I mean, when they scored the first goal, the Koulibaly volley, which is amazing. I mean, I don't know many centre-backs, certainly not in this room, who could have scored a volley like this.
I know zero in this room that could have scored a volley like that. I'll be completely honest with you. Completely honest, yeah.
But then even after the Reece James, when you think, okay, Chelsea now are in control, they were the better team. And I mean, Harry Kane made the point even after that, Spurs didn't deserve a point, deserve a draw. Do you think that Chelsea a bit hard done by the result in the end?
I think you all feel that. Like, to take the lead twice and to have long periods of possession, to feel like you have the momentum, have the good territory as well. Mm. Like, to come away with a 2-2 draw, like, you'd be disappointed. And, you know, conceding from a set piece, you know, these are things which you do practice, things which you can sort of, like, try and prepare for. But I don't know. I suppose the other side of the coin is like for Spurs, you've gone away to Stamford Bridge, not played your best and gotten a point. So you wonder what would have happened if we did play better. Mm. Because I think for Spurs, tactically, you could see what they were kind of trying to do. And like, it was quite, it's hard to play against, you know what I mean, without being glamorous. They did press okay sometimes, but you could see what they were trying to work on. But yeah, if you're a Chelsea fan, you think you're walking away thinking, how's that happened? Because all the joy is with the Spurs fans and the Spurs players and thinking, you know, we're going to be just fine because Chelsea can't give you more than that.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, tactically, we'll dissect a little bit more what they need to do. But you can have all the game plan you want, all the tactics. If at some point you feel that the referee didn't do his job, and certainly how Thomas Tuchel and the Chelsea players felt on the two goals. The first one, there's that foul by Bentancur on Havertz high up the pitch, and then 45 seconds later Højbjerg scores, and then the Cucurella Romero pulling of the hair just before the Hurricane goal. What, as a player, would you feel really frustrated, especially the Havertz one, because you everybody could see it on the pitch? Do you lose your
I think it's easy for Havertz to lose his focus. I think for the other Chelsea players, like, they couldn't just stop, so they defended it in a normal manner, but Havertz was, you know, out the picture, and he's right to be. Because, and I've got to say this might be a controversial take, but I think in the slow-mo, it looks like Bentancur gets his toe on it.
Yes,
but in real time, it doesn't look like that. And the referees and the four officials, they work in real time, not in slow motion.
So, that's true.
Should be able to see that looks like it's a foul. I think afterwards, you may make the decision that it's wrong, but nobody's going to be arguing about that decision if they give it as a free kick. So for then the player to develop the way that it does, you've seen it. We've seen so many games. It's in the back of your mind, like, here is a scenario. If Spurs score now, we're going to be talking about that. And lo and behold, they ended up scoring. And, you know, there was even a question about, was Richarlison blocking Mendy's view? So, you know, when you look at all the things where you feel like you're being hard done by, you know, that's almost, they could have defended it better.
I think Jorginho
made a mistake as well. But I could see that being given a foul in a normal game and nobody complaining about it.
You know, the issue I had with it is I can understand why Havertz goes mad.
Yeah.
But instead of shouting at the linesman who is right by him, to be fair, if he'd maybe got up and chased the ball, they would have recovered the ball maybe earlier and the goal doesn't happen. Instead, he spends 10 seconds shouting at the ref and not caring at all where the ball is and what he should do.
I totally agree with that. And in the same breath, I can picture how frustrated I would be if I felt like I'd been robbed that way as well. And I think for some players, they feel like they can be like that because you look at the area where it's happened. It's not as if he's done it 30 yards from his own goal and he's chasing an official. He's halfway into the Spurs half. And he, like, there's a reason he tried to run across Bentancur. It's to try and win the free kick. So he's doing his job, trying to be a good professional. And then that happens. But I agree, if he would have gotten up and chased back in, maybe even just fouled someone and stopped the attack, then fair enough, because in fairness, Bentancur got up and he played the ball next after that, didn't he?
That's true.
But then I can understand the frustration because, you know, in real time, it did really feel like a really obvious free kick that's been missed. Yeah.
And you understand then when Reece James scores the second goal, Thomas Tuchel goes mad and sprints, which I think Antonio Conte said after that, I didn't see him actually. I'm sure he saw him. But then what was your view on this? Like
stuff.
Head-to-head kind of thing between Tuchel and Conte, the handshake where
exactly, yeah. So the first incident came after the Spurs' first goal, didn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And Conte sort of went over towards the other box, you know, like Tuchel's there and he sees it and he's right to be frustrated because, you know, as a manager, like as a player, you can take out your frustration because someone's on the field, you can go and do whatever. As a manager, they're putting you in this little 10-meter box and say you must stay here right next to the opposition. So Conte didn't need to go over, but that's who Conte is. So for Tuchel, is he just going to take it? No. So then there's a little thing, the little back and forth while separated by that 1 meter between the two squares. But then after that, like, Tuchel getting his own back, you know. Felt very Mourinho-like.
Yeah, of course.
Felt very Mourinho-like. And also,
sprint.
Conte said he didn't see it. He didn't see it because after the goal went in, he put his head down. Sometimes put your head down when you don't want to see it. Let's just put it that way. And then the handshake at the end. Do you know what it reminded me of? I just came across it recently. There's like a sport which is like boxing, but they tape their hands together like over a table. You see arm wrestling. And then it's just like you're just swinging at each other. You're not allowed to let go at all. But yeah, it in some ways, it makes for a more exciting game because you see how much it means to both managers. If they were both very, very passive, then, you know, it wouldn't mean anything. But my friend said, that would be such a great fight. Conte would win. I said, it'd probably be too tactical. Everybody's just faking out. I'm going to do that. But yeah, it was a nice round into like a Sunday's afternoon's worth of football with two really good sides, top managers as well.
I mean, it's a good one. I don't know who would win between Tuchel and Conte as a proper fight, like an MMA type.
It'd be deeply tactical. Two people not hitting each other, yeah. Literally faking each other out all the time.
So obviously Tuchel has the height.
Yeah, has the height, yeah.
Above Conte. Conte has the hair.
Yeah.
Sure. Not sure that would help in the fight.
Speaking of hair, there was that incident on Cucurella where he had his hair pulled, but apparently that's not a foul, so.
That's not. And the thing about that is that Anthony Taylor, who I don't really rate, I have to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't think he's the worst referee, but I don't think he's very good either.
Uh-huh.
He's right there. So, okay, maybe he's got his eye on the corner that was obviously taken from over there.
Yeah.
But they're literally like where I am to you, this is where Romero is to pull his hair. And like you said, he's on a yellow card.
Yeah.
So this is a red.
Yeah.
It's a free kick for Chelsea. Chelsea win the game easily. Romero misses the next game in the league. I mean, this is...
The reasons to be unhappy for the Chelsea persuasion. And worse still is I think it went to the video. So if somebody's at Stockley Park and they're looking at the video of somebody having their hair pulled and they're like, well...
But they can only give it if it's a straight red.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's why they... So they can say to the ref, you have to go back and give a red card. But if it's anything else, like just a free kick, they can't give it. Just a yellow card, they can't give it. Even if that means a red card, it has to be a straight red.
So that's the problem with the laws, in my opinion, then.
Or VAR, or the use of VAR, or there could be a line somewhere with VAR saying in those kind of circumstances, where that's got such a big impact on what's happening on the game, maybe you can just alert the referee and say, listen, go and have a look and you can give a free kick and that'd be fine. I don't know.
Do you know, for all the like football purists out there, and you'll know this because, you know, you watch a lot of European football and have done for a long time. As I saw the goal back, I looked at the in-swinging left foot cross from the set piece and I was like, who got the assist there? It was Perisic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just casually went over, so I'm just going to whip this in with my left, sometimes my right. Like,
but did you see? Yeah, because you see the free kick before from the other side. He takes it with his right.
Yeah, literally like that. That is slept on class because it's a magnificent ball as well.
I know.
But yeah, what were you talking about? We're talking about those guys not being able to fight, being too tactical. But what did you think? Because you play fantasy football, don't you? What did you think about seeing Reece James playing in the back three instead of playing higher?
So I always kind of knew that Tuchel, especially in those games, would use this hybrid back four, back five. Because really, Reece James was at times a third centre back with Loftus-Cheek coming quite deep.
Yeah.
And that was a back five. And I think James was the one with the license to come out of the line of five to go and press whoever gets the ball from Spurs, either Kane or Son, which he did really well until Richarlison, you know, came on. But at times, he was also a normal right back with a back four. Loftus-Cheek would come inside, and especially to beat the Spurs press.
Yeah.
Loftus-Cheek was always the one almost on his own. And I don't think that Spurs, because they try to press, you know, like man-to-man, could deal with it until Richarlison came on. So I don't mind the hybrid back four, back five. I think James is so clever and so good that he can easily do it. Okay, now I'm in the three, now I'm in the four. When I'm in the four, I'm like a pure right back.
Mm.
When I'm in the three, Loftus-Cheek is going to be there, and I'm tighter to Silva and Koulibaly, and that's no problem.
Yeah.
I don't know how often they will do that, but I like the fact that Tuchel does that.
You sound like a man that's not going on your fantasy football team.
No.
That's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like. Because to me, it's very stressful. Like when he scores the goal, it's like, yeah, you should have been there for the last 60 minutes. Please be that high every single week. You know, that was real pain, yeah.
So that was different because Azpilicueta had come on.
Yeah.
So back then, he was only a pure back five, and Reece James was really the right wing back. Before that, until Richarlison came on. What I love in that game, Ned, is that Richarlison comes on 54th, I think it was, because clearly Spurs were outsmarted, outplayed, could not get the ball to Kane. I mean, could not do. There's the chance for Sessegnon because they caught Chelsea sleeping.
Yeah.
But apart from that, they've got nothing. They can hardly do three passes together.
Mm-hmm.
Richarlison comes on, you got two up front and Kane a little and Son a little bit behind, and then that brings you more power. He runs a lot. And then Tuchel, almost as soon as Richarlison comes on, Azpilicueta comes on, Loftus-Cheek is off, Reece James goes to wing, and then you go to a proper back five. Yeah. I love when managers like sort of respond to each other tactically like this.
Yeah, for sure. It was actually really good. And I thought, you know, for Spurs, I think they took off Sessegnon and they put Davies just at left back. But Davies, I think, is a good player, but I think he gets exposed more so at left back. So then when Reece James is up against him directly, you can see Reece James wanted to be more on the front foot. Not necessarily saying that was the reason for the goal, but it sort of changes the mentality and that tactical switch as well. Because I thought Richarlison would be playing instead of one of the front three.
Yeah, me too.
Not getting put in. So if this is how they perceive him, then that is interesting.
Yeah, the 4-4-2. You go 4-4-2
The only thing I'd say that felt a bit different though, I felt like it was Kane that was dropping off more than, say, Son. Right. So a question to you, and this could be a really weird question, but like in, say, 3-4 years' time, do you see Kane leading the line or playing more like an attacking midfielder like Rooney was?
It's a good point. I think his natural evolution might be to drop a bit more and play as a 10.
I think he prefers that. It looks like he prefers that, to be honest.
It looks like it, but then he must love scoring goals. And I think, obviously, which is no-brainer, but the deeper you are, the harder it would be then to be in the box to finish the chances that you might have started. I don't know.
But for me,
I've said to you many times, for me, he's England's best number 9 and best number 10. There's not even a debate.
I'm so conflicted by it because I do see the goals he scored. He's technically one of the best finishers in the world. But then if a game, say like, if it was a different manager in that first half where Spurs don't get a ton of the ball, under other managers, I think he'd be coming deeper to just go and try and get touches and move the ball around and things like that. But because Conte is almost demanding that he stays up there, then he's having to do something which maybe I don't feel he, not necessarily wants to do, but I feel like he wants to be part of the game. And sometimes in the 9 position, as we've seen within football, you get the least amount of touches, don't you? And I don't think that necessarily
suits him. For example, the Højbjerg goal, before Cucurella and Jorginho make a mess of getting the ball back and, you know, on the sort of left-hand side of the box, it's him who switched the play.
Mm.
And I mean, I'm sure Haaland can do it maybe. I'm sure Darwin can do it. You know, I'm sure Gabriel Jesus. But to see Kane with so much ease doing a switch like that, 50 yards across.
He enjoys that.
Like if he was, I don't know, you know, Busquets or Fabinho, I don't know, one of, or centre back.
Yeah.
I'm just like, wow.
Yeah, he's very, very good at that, to the point whereby I wonder if he gets more joy from that.
Yeah, maybe.
As opposed to maybe looking for scraps to like try and find a finish. Because you can see there's this confliction when I'm watching football where I see a pass that's on, but no, if I was on the field, I wouldn't play it.
Yeah.
So when he gets it and you see someone's free on the far side, you know they're going to try and play that 50, 60-yard ball, or say there's potential for through ball, you know they're going to play it.
Yeah, you know.
And he's definitely that because he has the confidence and the ability to be able to do it. But yeah, I'm interested anyway. Do you think Richarlison's going to have a big part to play this season, or is he going to be just like this?
Yeah, just like this. And he might start and you might have to rotate at some point anyway, because when Champions League starts at the beginning of September, which is only in like, 3 weeks' time, there are going to be so many games. So I think he can, but I don't think he can drop Kane really unless he's struggling with fitness or something.
Yeah, which I doubt he's going to be allowed to be struggling.
Yeah, and you can play, I guess you can play Richarlison wide for Kulusevski, for example. But
Kulusevski's so good though.
I don't know.
Do you think, I'm now thinking, is it going to be Son that ends up missing out?
Nah, you can't drop Son.
Why not?
That's why.
Why not?
Son is too good. And, you know, like, I still think that when you play, okay, yesterday, and you were gutted because you're, I mean, in your fantasy team, but
allegedly, he's maybe in my team, yeah.
But
maybe.
The problem is, if there's no space for him to run into, and if you press him and you're aggressive on him straight away, that's where he struggles.
Yeah.
Of course he does.
Listen, it was heartbreaking. It was a heartbreaking match. Let's just say that.
But we talked about the Spurs character, which I think is very important. When you don't play well,
yes.
Again, you know, Kane himself said they deserve to lose. When you don't play well, but you fight until the last minute, Richarlison really, I think, helped them.
Yeah.
I don't think people in this country have spoken enough, and you spotted it as well, that Perisic, who basically gives the assist on the Kane goal because he takes the corner, but a minute before took the corner from the other side with his right foot and then the other one with the left foot. I don't think many people in the Premier League era have seen players in the same game taking this in like, swinger with the 2 feet.
There's like Santi Cazorla that I can think of the top of my head.
But I'm not sure if he did it even as often as Perisic.
No, you're probably right. And in some ways, it's very hard to defend against because you just don't know.
Yeah.
Like when... Say, whether you're defending corners, when you're defending corners and free kicks, if you see a right foot to go out to your left-hand side, you know it's an outswinger. So you end up being a little bit higher, closer to the six-yard box, because you know that's the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
But then if you see him go over there and it looks like he's going to do an outswinger, but then all of a sudden he's now in a position to do an in-swinger and you're like, hold on a second, like, we're not set for this. Like, what are we supposed to do here? Or worse still, as I'm sure some people will face throughout the season, when he's running at you, and he could literally go whichever way he wants and put in the same quality of ball. Like, it's always easy when you know somebody prefers one side, so you try and take that away.
Yeah.
And you make them uncomfortable. But if he's comfortable going both ways, then it's going to be a tough, tough spot for people to be in.
You know, I think one of the evolutions we could see in next year is, but to be fair, I thought about it 5 years ago and it hasn't happened. But I thought 5 years ago that by now, there would be far more players like Perisic or Cazorla, almost as good with the 2 feet. And I thought this was, you know, it would naturally be the evolution of coaching, for example, or training, that you would teach 15-year-olds that their left foot or their right foot is as important as their strong foot. And that by now, more people would be so comfortable right and left, which is not really the case.
I don't think it is. But I think the reason for that is because the players we're talking about, they're exceptional with both. I think there are some players who are really good with one and quite good with the other, but will always lean towards the one which they're really good with. Like, not to say it's different, or it is a bit different. Like, Kevin De Bruyne with his left foot. Like, I've seen him.
Yeah,
it's insane.
Yeah.
But he doesn't take corners with it.
No, yeah, not to that point.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And again, he's a unicorn. But there'll be players who are comfortable using another foot, but they just don't have the bottle to be able to use it.
Maybe,
whereas for these guys, like, it's second nature.
Natural, yeah.
The ones where you ask them which foot today and they say they don't know.
Yeah, Dembele.
I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? If you don't know, what chance have I got trying to stop you if you don't know yourself?
So we spoke about Spurs. Let's go back to Chelsea a bit. We talked about Reece James's position and that interesting hybrid back four, back five or three. What did you make of Raheem Sterling? So clearly now, because it's the second game back to back, Everton, he played centrally as well with Havertz. He did it again yesterday against Spurs. There's the assist for James where he's got acres of space. I don't even know how is that possible at that time of the game.
Yeah.
But I still struggle a little bit. In the sense that I like him playing there and I think he's an amazing player. I still wonder if he might be more efficient wide and taking players.
Like really wide, you think?
Yeah, or taking players, you know, like one-on-one, having a bit more space, facing the game more than sometimes having his back to goal.
Yeah.
Or if you think that this is, again, natural evolution for him under Tuchel, that he will play in that position and thrive in that position.
I feel like it's closer to how he plays for England. It's a bit more central. He doesn't really take people on like that. But I think one thing about him, especially within this Chelsea setup, like Chelsea don't really have wingers that take people on, do they?
No, yeah, true, because of the wing backs.
Most of the width comes from the wing backs or like bombing fullbacks. So for somebody to be playing inside and off someone, I think in some ways it's possibly a bit more beneficial because it's another body in the box who's capable of finishing.
Yeah.
Because if you do take him out wide, then he has that sort of impact in terms of getting balls in the box and the like. Like, I'll be honest as well, I thought Chelsea put a lot of crosses into the box yesterday, but there were never really crosses which felt that dangerous. But I kind of like him a bit more central because his link-up play can be good. There was one which he set up for, I think, Havertz, where it was saved by Lloris with his right foot. You know, so he's very intelligent and he's desperate to score.
Yeah.
And I think for Chelsea, like, you want those people to be as close to the goal as possible. So I think in time it will probably work itself out. But then also, like, I think I quite like Havertz up there, you know.
The two can maybe
They link up pretty well. And I think if you get a better sort of link with Mount as well, then I think it could be really good. But then my only concern for, well, not like, you know, I don't feel sorry for them or anything. Like, they'll be fine. But my only concern as such is, does the team that they have at the start of play at this moment suit them in terms of scoring 80-plus goals this season if they want to win a Premier League title? At the moment, obviously they scored two yesterday, but at the moment it doesn't really feel like that.
Mm.
But then in the same breath, I don't know who they could possibly bring in or a style of play they could change that would bring that along.
Yeah, we'll come on to the targets because the Anthony Gordon one is quite fascinating.
Yeah,
same as Aubameyang. But just to finish on Chelsea and the game... The bad news is that N'Golo Kanté, who I thought was very good until the injury, got injured again. It looks like a hamstring. I mean, he was holding the back of his thigh, which I think would be a huge blow for Chelsea overall, but also for him in the World Cup year as well, which is a real shame. I was worried through the summer about Chelsea. I said it before the season started that I was worried. I put them out of my top four, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I know since then they've added a Cucurella, and I think they're gonna sign another two or three maybe. So in the end, like you said, they should be okay anyway. I was reassured by the performance yesterday. Yep, I thought the press was outstanding, certainly for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they created enough to score more goals. You said Havertz, the one that Lloris said, there's one that goes just wide, there's one that goes over the bar, the Reece James cross from the right hand side. So I was a bit reassured really on how they will play and what they can do.
Yeah, I would agree with that because I, like you, had them outside the top four, and it felt like a really bad take yesterday as I'm watching it. but worse still, though, I'm sure the people, our colleagues at ESPN, are listening to this. I had Man United in fourth, and I've been ridiculed I know. I got sucked in yet again by Manchester United. And obviously, in time, they could get better, but like it just feels really obvious. At this moment in time,
because
I'm thinking Chelsea, there's so much change. But then it's the same manager, and you look at the starting 11, and it's very similar in terms of the way that they're going to play. The key players are still within it. Mm. You know, if everybody's available, you're seeing like Chilwell and Reece James on the field, who are like two of their most significant players when it comes to attacks. You've got Mount in there, you've got Jorginho's, you've got Kante's, Kovacic's, you've got Havertz, all that.
Yeah.
Thiago Silva, like that's a lot of continuity
in
a place that is allegedly full of change. So I got sucked in, you know, I read too much nonsense, listened to too much nonsense, and I hold my hands up and say Man United in fourth is probably the worst take I've had since I thought Leicester City were going to go down the year before they won the Premier League title. So I own it, I hold my hands up, it's what it is, yeah.
So. Right, let's talk about, it's been an interesting summer in terms of the transfer window for Chelsea. I think interesting is the right word.
Yes.
Considering their new owner is also the sporting director right now, which is crazy, and Tuchel has a big role to play, and rightly so. Anthony Gordon is the last player for whom they made an offer, which I struggle to understand why, to be honest, unless that means a Pulisic is going soon.
Mm.
I mean, even Ziyech is not really a similar kind of player to Gordon.
No.
But anyway, 40 million, been rejected. We hear that Everton won at least 50.
Mm.
Where do you stand first on them trying to get Gordon, on Gordon itself as a player, I guess? And then Aubameyang is the other one where you could go and get. But surely it would come as a sub, right? Because Havertz and Sterling look like that's the pair that Tuchel fancy.
Yeah, that's the way it does look. But maybe... he'd be playing in games where Mount's not playing. Maybe they go for like a three up top, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. But then also, I don't know, to start with the Aubameyang thing, like, I think he's obviously a very good player. I think his stock couldn't be much lower in England at the moment based on how he left England and the certain documentary that's out, which, you know, kind of reveals some stuff which most people didn't know. And also, he's 33. You know, as a manager, it feels like there should be some sort of duty for you to be not necessarily future-proofing your side, but to be preparing for the future and thinking what it'll look like, not just this season, but like looking at the years to come. So I'm surprised that that's going on, but I can't, objectively, he's a good player. Will he start, like you say? I don't know. And then for the Anthony Gordon one, like he's a big prospect.
Yeah.
But it's £50 million for a prospect these days, for a prospect that at the moment, I couldn't put him down into this Chelsea team and understand how he fits.
Yeah, that, I agree with you.
You know what I mean? Because I'm looking at Ziyech, looking at Pulisic and so on. And like, they're technically really good players, but it's not like they spend the whole time taking people on. Whereas for Gordon, that's one of his huge strengths. Yeah. And to be down playing for Chelsea, having the expectation that every game is a winnable game, and if you don't win two in a row, then it's like a mini crisis.
Mm.
I feel like you kind of need strong mentalities at that point who can understand how to deal with that pressure.
Yeah.
And I don't think Anthony Gordon at this moment in time is that. So to be spending £50 million on it, you know, it feels like a long-term signing potentially, but then I still also don't see how it fits in with this current style of play.
I know. I mean, I guess it's a different profile, but when you see a player like a Callum Hudson-Odoi, for example, who you know, is not going to play much, so he wants to leave, and you put Anthony Gordon next to it, I'm like, why don't you keep the money and invest maybe a bit more time on Hudson-Odoi and giving, you know, he's a boy from the club.
Do you not think that's kind of a revealing thing, though? Because how is Callum Hudson-Odoi not playing in Chelsea, or why is he not playing in Chelsea? And it might be because of the style of play that he has.
Or something we don't
know. It might be something with the owner, but like the style of play, because he's somebody who's very good at dribbling, can run without the ball and all this stuff. So basically, it's another version of Anthony Gordon.
I know.
And if he can't get into this side at this moment in time when everybody's fit, then
I agree.
Where would you, literally, I can't pick, at this moment, and I, you know, as you can see, I deliver tons of really bad takes.
No. I mean,
Man United in fourth is a really bad take. It does happen, but I just can't put him into this side at the moment and figure out how that makes them better.
I agree. And the other one is obviously Wesley Fofana. I believe they've had already two bids rejected. The second one up to 70 million, which is already a lot of money. I think Leicester at 80 would sell.
How do people make up these figures? Did you just pick a number? Like, how does it work? Like,
well, the thing like that right now, a player at his age, I mean, this is Leicester, you know, who we know it's have quite high valuation of their own players.
Yeah.
Fair enough. The question is more if you're Chelsea, do you put the money? On yesterday's game, I mean, I know the marking on the Kane's goal. I mean, it's not just Kane. I think Richarlison can score if Kane doesn't get the ball, and there's another Spurs player. There's three of them on their own.
Yeah.
Defensively, do you think they need someone like Fofana for £80 million? Or they would just be fine with Thiago Silva, Reece James, Koulibaly, and Azpilicueta in those kind of positions, plus Chalobah, of course.
I think from when you spend the £80 million, the expectation is that the guy will play. But then if he's playing, it means that there's somebody significant that's going to be missing out. Mm. Somebody who understands either the culture at Chelsea or somebody who's like putting a lot of work beforehand. Because say if he comes in, he's going to play instead of Thiago Silva. He's going to play instead of Koulibaly.
He's
going to play instead of Azpilicueta, who's the club captain. Like, I don't know. That's one of those like future long-term level signings, and he's a very good player. But then again, like, you can't just accrue talent if it doesn't fit in to the sort of style of playing, the people, personnel that you have at the time. Like, I get that whatever's available is available, but still, I don't know. I think he'd help them. I think as overall the squad, he'd make them better.
But then
Thiago Silva's incredible. So cool about it. So. Yeah.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Right, enough Chelsea Spurs. What about some crickets, Nathan?
Allez, Jules.
Let's go. Manchester United are humiliated at Brentford in one of the worst defeats in their history. Nathan is going from bad to worse for them.
Yeah, pretty much. I think as soon as I said they'd finish fourth this year, everything seems
you
to have
jinxed them.
Yeah, maybe I did it on purpose. That's my excuse. But yeah, it was such a bad result, such a bad performance. And you know, we were speaking on FC before the game on the Friday, and we were thinking it's a poor state of affairs when we're thinking it's a good result for Man United to get a point away from home at Brentford. So for them to be 4-0 down at halftime away at Brentford, like, it does make you wonder where they really are at and how bad things actually are, because it's this nagging thing in the back of your mind that maybe they'll be okay. But stuff like this, it's not only affecting the people associated with Man United, but it affects the people playing against them, because you believe you can beat them.
Yes,
and when every team in the league believes you can beat them, they approach you in a different manner to how they'll play against, say, like Liverpool, Anfield and stuff like that. Yeah. So in some ways, I'm a bit concerned, but him being a Blue, I'm more than happy to get over it.
But it's just, I mean, that first half, everything
horrible
about it, from what they used, what they did with the ball, the defending on set PC, I mean, on the counter, anything.
Yeah, they did like nothing was good.
How can you be that bad? Do you know what I mean? I understand the Brighton game was bad.
Yeah, I've no idea.
This is another level.
And worse though, like, you know, we talk about United a lot. Every time United lose, it's the inquest into why United lost. But credit to Brighton, credit to Brentford.
Because
you know how they're going to play.
Yeah.
You know their identity. And the players from 1 to 11 might not match up to United's talent, but still, there's enough talent to be able to win a game. And I think the way that they did it with the pressing, with just getting in people's faces and all this stuff, like, if you're not going to be strong enough to be able to deal with that sort of pressure, then maybe you're not strong enough to be able to play for Manchester United in that environment.
But then in that sense, after the Brighton game, Ten Hag spoke a lot about, oh, they're low on confidence, you know, I need to... And we said, for example, with Gab, we said you can still see the scars from last season and everything. Then why are you asking them to play like that? De Gea to put those passes, to invite the pressure on you. You know, maybe just don't take any risk at the beginning.
It's because they cannot do the other thing either. There are some teams
there's nothing they can do.
There are some teams that can't go long and some teams that can't go short, you know. And if you're in a position where you can't do both, then you're in a very, very bad position. But anyway, Jules, what was Erik ten Hag's answer to his players' dreadful performance then?
Well, it's interesting you ask, because they were supposed to have a day off on Sunday. So
of course,
yesterday,
it's the Sabbath, of course.
Know. And instead, he made them come to the training ground. They ran 8.5 miles or something like that. He made them run like crazy. I'm not sure the running and the fitness work is the problem here. I'm sure they can run, you know, okay, maybe not as much as the fittest team in the league, or they can press like Liverpool or that kind of stuff. But I'm not sure if that's the issue right now. You can make them run. Of course, it's never bad to run and to get fitter. I just think there's other issues there for him to address even before you're going to go and run and do like 30 laps of the training pitch.
It's a power thing. As was the case with, say, like Conte doing the 42 lengths in the summer, you know what I mean? Like, you go at some point, it goes beyond like a physical development thing, comes to like a psychological one. And I think with that, having somebody who's played, when those stats go up on a Monday or Sunday or whenever after a game, if you've been outworked by the other team, like,
which is the case,
because I think Klopp believes that if you outwork the other side or hit a certain number, you're more likely to win a game.
Yeah,
I think the 8.5 miles was the difference in distance covered between both sets of players. And when you think about the fact it's 11v11 on the same size field, that's a lot. That's a lot. So I get what he was going for. Yeah.
Nathan, we could sing happy birthday to the Premier League, because this weekend was their 30th anniversary, which is pretty good.
What would be
your best memory? What would you pick? I think I know.
You do know, but it's not my best memory, but I think I understand why it matters so much to the Premier League. And I think it was that moment 10 years ago when City won the league in the last minute. Like, I played in the game and I lost. And when they scored, I thought it was going down. And the emotion was so high, I didn't know who scored the goal to make it 3-2 for a few days after, because I didn't track the game. So I'm not invested in the game from that standpoint, but I understand its significance, because when you want to have a league which people want to tune into, you want to be able to tune in throughout the whole season, because the league can be won in the final seconds. You know, you have to stay tuned. So that's what it is for me. What would you say is for you?
I don't know. I think the Invincible was pretty special.
Yeah.
Just to go the whole year, the whole season in the Premier League as unbeaten, even if you have 12 draws out of the 38 games, it's pretty special. I like your moment as well. I think it's such an iconic,
Listen, it's not my moment.
But the moment you picked, I mean, sorry. It's such an iconic moment. But I think there's a few. It's the best league in the world, and it will be for many, many more.
You'd expect so, PSG played very well again. You can't say that with an Arsenal. You've got an Arsenal shirt on.
Because it's, you know, it's my friend in the bag. But yeah,
anyway, one again, but yeah. Always with them. Controversy is never far away, is it?
Kylian Mbappe was grumpy, and then he missed a penalty.
Did he?
That make him even grumpier. And you could tell he was not enjoying the day. Then there's a second penalty, and Neymar, who is the second taker, took the ball, and they had a little bit of a like, you know, okay. And then Neymar took his score there. And Kylian was not happy at all.
Really?
Let's see if there's have consequences in the future.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Gabriel Jesus was amazing for Arsenal against Leicester on Saturday with 2 goals and 2 assists. Mikel Arteta said he would hate playing against each other. What about you?
Yeah, I'd hate playing against him. I'll be 100% honest, because he's constantly working hard. You know, obviously he's had those 2 goals and he's had the 2 assists. But, you know, if he's on the field, he's having an impact, whether it's a one-on-one duel with somebody or just ghosting around. And I think when you have that sort of player in your team, it's great. But when you're playing against it, you just think, just stop running for 1 second. Just relax. You know, and there are some players you play against who do like to relax, but Gabriel Jesus certainly is not one of them.
The one when he turns over Johnny Evans after he scored, I think, his first goal or the second goal, maybe. Yeah. Mm. But, you know, Johnny Evans is a tall,
big guy. Yeah. Jesus wants to mix it up with people as well. Some people don't like the contact, but I think he loves it and he knows it can have an effect, because you don't need to be the strongest. You need to be strong enough to be able to hold yourself.
Nah, that's what I mean.
And anyway, Real Madrid start the defense of their La Liga title with a win at Almeria, but they had to work for it, didn't they?
Yeah, they went behind early on. I mean, a goal where I think Rudiger is a bit half asleep and they don't defend it well, the spacing behind. And it's for Almeria, who are newly promoted, who won the second division last season, it was an amazing start. And then Real Madrid, slowly Vinicius, Benzema, you know, put the machine in place. Interesting choices from Carlo Ancelotti, who put Casemiro and Modric on the bench and started Camavinga and Tchouaméni, who were not at their best. I mean, Carlo said after the game that the show is heavy. And I think maybe, especially on Tchouaméni, that first start against a team that then defended really deep, you know, for Real Madrid not to try to come back. But they had enough chances. They won 2-1, lovely free kick by Alaba on his first touch. Literally came on to take the free kick, scored it top bins, and then that was it. The game was over. So it was not worrying anything. That goal, maybe the way they defended it, Rudiger. But again, it was a good performance. I thought they created enough to win the game easily, maybe 3-4.
Okay.
No problem at all. Scott Parker says that Manchester City is the best team he's ever seen, Nadem, as they dismantled his Bournemouth side 4-0, and Erling Haaland didn't even score.
He didn't, but he had an assist.
Yeah, for Gundogan.
If we're going to play the PR game, he had an assist.
I was just saying,
I get it, because I think for Scott Parker, you know, he played the game a lot of years. He's managed a few sides. He's played against City and so on. And managed against City. And, you know, I'm going to reference this through Erling Haaland. So a lot of people have seen how he only had 8 touches. He only made 2 passes. But he still had a big impact. Because for the way that City play and the way that he plays within that setup, you have to take his run seriously. You know, he's not somebody... I think there was a game last season with... I think it was Chelsea Palace where Lukaku had 2 touches or something.
Yeah, something like 16 touches or something.
But he didn't really have an impact, because firstly, people weren't looking for him. And secondly, he wasn't really making the sort of runs whereby they could as well. And so the way that the other team defended him was different to, say, the way Bournemouth would have to defend against Haaland. And I think with that, like, a question for you, how many touches do you want your striker to have in a game?
I don't know. I mean, I think...
That's low. That's obviously
low.
That's low,
but in the sense that if you're Haaland, though, are you happy by touching the ball only 8 times?
No. You 100% will not be, but then maybe this is the exception and not the rule.
No, that's true.
That's the thing. And I think when you come up against sides who will, say, have 1 million players back defensively, you know, you as the focal point of a side like this, you will have the fewest touches of anybody in your team.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the same all across the board.
Yeah, because they had 70% of the ball.
Exactly. Like, City have got 70% of the ball, and most of it's going to be with their back line and their midfield, deeper midfielders. Like, Cancelo might have 70 touches, 80 touches. But for him, I think he understands his position and he doesn't roam. He continues to do that job.
Yeah.
And I think that for them is going to be a positive long term. And I think if, you know, there are a few moments where I think Foden could have squared one to him, there's still that sort of thing where they don't expect somebody to be there yet, but they've got a 6'2" Norwegian striker desperate to score that's in and around it. So I guess when they look for him more and he links up better and understands better, he'll have more touches.
It was interesting to see what Pep said after the game when there's that chance where Foden has a shot and he's saved by Travers, when he can easily have squared the ball and Haaland was there on his own and he would have been a tap-in and he didn't cross. And Pep says, like all of us, yeah, he should have crossed the ball. And Pep said, but that in their head, because they've played so many years without a number nine, that you maybe would not have someone in that position to square the ball to.
Yeah.
Then the first reaction for a Foden, or De Bruyne, a Bernardo Silva, a Mahrez, is to take that shot.
Yep.
And that now they just need to get used to think that the big Norwegian is going to be there. So you can pass the ball there.
Yeah, for sure. I think to give them more credit, and obviously people are like, oh my gosh, this ex-City player is giving Man City credit.
No, but to give
them more credit, the way what they've been so good at, as is the case for Liverpool, is understanding the right pass, the right run, and the right everything based on whatever formation they're playing.
Yeah.
So City don't, maybe Foden didn't square that ball there because he's not expecting to see a nine there. But then City have also scored over 200 goals in the last two seasons combined without a number nine.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, like they've been making the right decisions more often than not. But now the right decision has changed because there's somebody else there who's going to be in a different spot to say the way somebody else would be.
Yeah, it's a good, interesting
decision. Yeah, it's for sure. So only two goals this time for Bayern Munich against Wolfsburg. But once again, Jamal Musiala is the star of the show, Jules.
Oh, my word. He scored only one this time. He's got 3-2 now in the two first games in the league. He's 19, but he's so good. And you see the goal that he takes. He's so strong on his legs. There's a couple of challenges. He stayed up. Really good, clever finish. Just everything he does with the ball, without the ball, everything is almost perfect. We talked about decision-making for the Foden cross. Yeah. His decision-making is not always, but very often just like perfect, you know, in the right timing, the right weight on the pass, everything. I'm just amazed. I don't know where he can go and how far he can go, but I'm like, wow, every time I watch
him. You say where he can go, like, are you talking about actually moving?
No. I mean, like, right, what kind of level?
And who's he playing instead of at the moment for the attacking
talent? I guess Leroy Sané. So they played again 4-2-2-2 with Müller, Mane, and then Gnabry and Musiala, and then Sabitzer was in Kimmich. So there's not as much width as they used to before. So you don't play two proper wingers, for example. But he can, for me, he could play anywhere. I can even see him playing deeper, almost next to Kimmich. I just think he's an amazing talent. Going back to Man City, Nathan, there's still a lot of noise around Bernardo Silva's future. But tell me something. Why would they let him go, please? Because I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't think they want to let him go.
Right.
But one thing which they say openly, and you can probably see from their transfer policies, they say if somebody doesn't want to stay or they want to go, they'll allow them the opportunity if the price is right. You know, it's not somebody that's been put on a transfer list.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been a significant part of the club for many years now. But like I say, I think one thing which they have in this moment is sort of leverage. If somebody says that they want to leave, what they're leaving is one of the best clubs and teams in the world with the greatest ambition as any team on planet Earth. So when those people say they want to leave, it must be quite significant that they want to do that.
Yeah, fair enough.
And in fairness to them, like, you know, if somebody says they want to leave, you'd rather have a happy group of players as opposed to 99% of them happy and one or two not happy, because that sort of unhappiness can be the reason why, you know, you don't end up winning a league, because when it comes down to there being 1 point difference, maybe that 1 point came when somebody didn't run back as much as they should have done, because there's some level of sadness within them. So Stefano Pioli chooses Ante Rebic to start up front for Milan and is proven right as the Croatian scores twice against Udinese.
Yeah, I think it was good, Rebic. So he started because Giroud was not completely fully fit. Charles de Ketelaer, the young Belgian striker that they signed from Bruges, who's the big transfer signing, was on the bench. And obviously Ibra is injured. Rafael Leao, you know, is more of a wide player. So Rebic took his chance well. You know, they scored the two goals. They fell behind. And Udinese are a decent team, to be fair. But I like the way Milan responded, going one goal down. Even when Udinese came back to 2-2, I think they'd never panicked. They're looking good. It's going to be, as we said with Don Hutchinson in the last show, such an open league in Serie A, I think, with Inter Milan and Juventus and Napoli and Roma and Milan, for them to retain the title, that it would be quite fascinating to follow.
You think so. Roma, yeah?
Yeah, I think so too. And they were good yesterday. It was only Salernitana, but They played some good stuff. Zaniolo, Tammy,
okay.
Dybala, all of that was really interesting. So I think it's going to be a good season in Serie A, and I think Milan started it well.
Mm-hmm.
23 years after their last season in the Premier League, Nottingham Forest are back at home in style with their first win of the season against West Ham. Ned, were you impressed?
I sound like the really negative guy, but I wasn't that impressed, to be honest, no. But I think
but the way they played.
I've seen how they've played because I've seen him in the Championship. I've played against him in the Championship. Yeah. I've seen that manager before. He's a good manager. He's a good coach. And I see how they're going to try and do it. But then I also saw West Ham, and I thought West Ham overall were poor yesterday.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't necessarily want to get too excited about it, but it's good to see them back in there. But just because you're a big historic club doesn't necessarily give you the right to be there and to stay up, as we've seen.
Yeah.
Because, I think up until last year, they haven't been that close in the grand scheme of things coming back.
Definitely.
So there were players in their team who would arrive at the club and wouldn't feel the same about Nottingham Forest to say we would do, talking about Van Hooydonks or Brian Clough and all that stuff. Yeah. But fair play to them for getting the first win. The goal wasn't exactly the best finish I've ever seen, but still a goal in the Premier League when it just hits you and goes in.
Yeah, because it's just
it's fantastic. And I think if they've got a very, very passionate crowd, going to their stadium's a very, very tough place to go. So I think as long as the players can give the fans something to get behind, then I think they'll be all right. But if that starts to go, then before you know it, I think the realities of the Premier League might hit them because, at the end of the day, they are still one of the favourites to go down, even though they have rich history.
For sure.
So Barcelona, and this is even with Lewandowski, I take it, could not score against Rayo Vallecano for the first game of the season, Jules. What was lacking?
It's a good question, Nate, because they had, I think, 26 shots and 7 or 9 on target. Expected goals, way above zero. And yet, either we saw Lewandowski with a few headers, a good shot, just going wide, lack of maybe sharpness in front of goal. The last pass was not always the best. They had a lot of the ball, as you would expect. But maybe not so surprisingly, conceded 2 huge chances, maybe the best 2 chances in the game, were from Rayo Vallecano and Cabello on the counter, where they could easily have scored. So I thought it was a little bit worrying to see Barca leaving so much space on the counter for the opposition, and yet themselves not being able to seize the opportunities that they had with Dembele, with Rafinha. Is it going to be a problem that Rafinha plays on the left hand? Well, he played on the right and Dembele on the left, but both of them really are the best on the right hand side.
Yeah.
And you can't play them both on the right. So one of them will have to sort of sacrifice himself to go on the other side. Sorry, to go on the other side when he's not as good. Mm. Lewandowski, you could tell, wanted to do well. But should have scored at least 1. So it'd be interesting.
Who scores more this year out of Lewandowski and Benzema?
Kareem the Dream! I mean, that's not even a question.
And how old is Benzema?
So he's one is 34, one is 33. So Benzema is 34.
So Barcelona signed the younger talent to try and
34 and 34, but I think Kareem is 35 in December and Lewandowski is only 35 the following year, maybe something like that.
Okay, so you're going for Kareem, yeah?
Who'd you go for? If you ever want to do this show again, you know what to answer.
Listen, everyone knows whatever I say will be wrong. So do you want me to say the same thing as you?
Actually, yeah, say Lewandowski.
Okay, I'll say Benzema then.
Oh, no. So going back quickly to Forest, Nathan, their transfer dealings are out of hands.
Yes.
This summer. I mean, crazy. They have signed Freuler, Emmanuel Dennis, Kouyaté, and while they're waiting on Neil Mopé's decision to come from Brighton as well, and Usamawa too, from Lyon, which looks like this one's going to happen too. So 2 questions. Here, they are very good players, all of them. Some have experience, like Kouyaté, who you don't think will start every single game and play every single game, but he brings experience. Freuler, Emmanuel Dennis, Awa, really good player. Neil Mopé, really good player. Do they need all those new players? You've been in squads where I'm sure you've seen squads with transfer windows where a lot of players were coming. Is that a good thing? Because you also need to gel.
Yeah, I think the gelling is a key thing. And I think Forest did need new players because apparently there were a lot of players that were on loan last season and contracts that were running out.
Yeah, like Joe Spence and people like that.
So
but
with that being said, they need to bring more on. But to be seeing 15, 16 players coming in. When you think of it, that's more than half a Premier League squad.
Yeah.
So firstly, what happens to the players that stayed? Secondly, in regards to the players who are coming in, are they I think you need to make sure the manager and the club sign the right players, because if people are just signing because it's in the Premier League, then if Forest appeared at any point to be teetering and to be struggling, then a lot of those players would be thinking about their next option to go. Whereas the players you sign for a football club, you want them to believe that they'll stay there for many years. Like, you sign a 3-4 year deal in the hopes of staying there for 3-4 years. But I think the Forest thing, for as good as history as they have and a good fan base, you know, it's a great city for football, you just got to be wary of one or two that you might sign. Yeah. The turnover of that, well, you know, if they go down, these guys are going. But I think it seems like the manager's good. Yeah, it seems like the identity of the football club's there. It seems like they have a style of play which these players coming in can be a part of. But then at the end of the day, as you said, it's about relationships. Yeah. I need to know that if I'm coming forward, I can look to my right and know this player's going to be here because we've done it thousands of times.
Yeah, yeah.
But now when you're doing it for the first time, you realise like Kouyaté is a good player, but he's played in the Premier League in a team, not as an individual. Yeah, so at the end of the day, that stuff kind of matters, doesn't it? Yeah, what do you think?
I think it's interesting. I can see they're upgrading a lot of the positions with better players, which is great. That doesn't mean that
Usamawa
will be better than the midfielder that they already have, who's been playing there for a while, who knows English football, which Usam doesn't know, for example. As much as I love Usamawa, I'm not so sure how well he will do in a team like Forest in the Premier League, for example.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be interesting. I like Freuler, I like Emmanuel Dennis. But how many strikers do you know? You've got Brennan Johnson, who is the diamond of your academy, who was so good last season in the Championship. Awoniyi, who scored on his home debut, the winning goal against West Ham. How many strikers do you need and to play with? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you have Mope and Emmanuel Dennis and Johnson,
there'll be a lot of disappointment
and
there.
And you're like, okay, right.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I'm all for it. They've spent over 120 million, something like that now.
It's nice when you have it, huh?
Yeah, we'll see.
Anyway, Romelu Lukaku's back in Serie A and he picked up right where he left off, Jules.
Yes, my man, it took him 81 seconds.
Is that all?
Hey, that's all. 81 seconds to score. Good header on the left hand, good cross on the left hand side, DiMarco, and then the header across by Damian, and then he's there to just tap it in. And I think he's such a Lukaku goal in a way, so quickly. There's not much else in his game, to be fair. He didn't touch the ball much. I think they're still working out how to play with him again, in a way, because let's not forget that for Simone Inzaghi, who is now the coach, Lukaku was playing under Conte. So for him,
it was
Dzeko, who is a different player to Lukaku last season. But they will get there. And I think they'll be around there. They won 2-1 in the last minute, which against Lecce, the newly promoted side, which was not a given. And they didn't play that great. But I expect them to improve with the games. But it was good to see, you know, Rom scoring like that. I know he scored on his debut with Chelsea last season in the Premier League. And then we saw what happened. So it's not a guarantee that he's going to score many now.
That smells of a disclaimer, what you're putting out here.
But yeah, I think it was good for him. 81 seconds is pretty quick.
Yeah, you want that. You want that going back to a place where, you know, you want to feel like everyone likes you again. So 81 seconds, if anything, is probably a bit too long.
Yeah, exactly. Liverpool playing a few hours on Monday night. We're recording this on Monday morning. And Jurgen Klopp says that they won't buy a midfielder in a rush. He didn't say we won't buy one at all, but he said we're not going to rush things. Do they need, though? Did they need one, though, Ned? Because obviously you've got Harvey Elliott, I guess, as an option.
Yeah.
Thiago's injury is a...
Yeah, but the injury, they're not saying it's like 4 to 6 weeks or something. Yeah. Like, if it was 4 to 6 months, then maybe there's more of a rush. But the 4 to 6 weeks, I feel like you can manage that, especially if you've got... So if we run through them, you have Fabinho, you have Henderson.
Yeah.
You have Keita, you have Elliott, you have Jones to come back in as well.
Oxlade-Chamberlain.
And Oxlade-Chamberlain. But I don't think they love Oxlade-Chamberlain, to be honest. So just there, we've mentioned six already. Six and Milner, seven.
Yeah, Milner.
So that's seven for three spots. You wouldn't necessarily think that, you know, bringing somebody in is going to be the answer to that. Because if you bring someone in, you're going to be bringing in someone in of quality.
Yeah.
Someone that's used to playing week in, week out. You know, it's not like a third choice goalkeeper whereby you can just have a training position.
Yeah.
So you could bring someone in, but is it really going to be a long-term thing for Liverpool? The likelihood is probably not. And I think they do have the quality and, you know, we're expecting them to be better tonight against Palace, because that in that first week they weren't great. Even Klopp said it himself, and I'm sure there'll be water in the field so they can move the ball well and all that jazz. I'm sure Salah will have a great day and have a hat-trick as well, isn't that right?
You wish.
Yeah, I am wishing. I'm not going to lie about that. Bayer Leverkusen's bad start of the season continues with another defeat, the third in three games, Jules.
Yeah, and that was a bad one against Augsburg. The first time ever they lost against them. I think they had 24 wins and one draw before.
Right, okay.
They lost 2-1. They were not they had a lot of chances. Their expected goals is like 2-6 or something like that. But they just could not score, Patrick Schick and Moussa Diaby and all the others. And they lost in the cup against the third division team to start the season. Then they back-to-back games against Dortmund and now against Augsburg, where they were so good last season that they're struggling now. And I think the pressure is high on Seoane, the manager. They need to get it right next weekend. They've got another home game. They've got back-to-back home games. They can't make those mistakes again defensively. They were poor on the goal they conceded and not taking the chances. And it's funny how they were so good last season for most of it, and now they find themselves bottom of the table, where really struggling to get going, and the pressure is already big on their manager. They will have Champions League football, of course. It's such a big start of the season where you can't have a slow start because you're already 6 points behind Dortmund, for example, you know, and Bayern and all those clubs. So, yeah, they need a big wake-up call, and maybe that defeat against Augsburg, as we said, might be one, you know. Mm. Nathan, we know the short list for the UEFA Player of the Season, and it's Karim Benzema, Thibaut Courtois and Kevin De Bruyne. No Mo Salah, though.
Yeah.
No space for him. That's surprising.
You see with these awards, they're so interesting because you can make a case for so many people in any given moment, any given season. Yeah. And as soon as you pick three, you're like, well, how about this guy? How about that guy? And I think Salah, for the way he started last season, was ridiculous. You know, he was literally ridiculous. But the second half of the season for Liverpool felt more about Mane than it did about Salah.
True.
So I think sometimes you sort of, when it comes down to making the nominations, you can lose momentum based on your form in that particular moment. Because as you look back, you see how great a season he had. But then you also think, well, Benzema had a great season. KDB had a very strong second half of the season.
But then if you look at KDB's season and Mo Salah's season individually and even, you know, collectively, it's just like, I don't know.
But when were the nominations first properly given out?
So those are made by managers and
towards the end of the last season though.
So no, I think they made them quite recently now in the summer.
So there's that recency and bias journalist. Because come the end of last season, Courtois saw there was real significance.
Courtois and Benzema, no debate.
Yeah. And then for KDB, he was lights out for the last 3-4 months of the season. Because if you go back to the start of the season, what we forget, he was coming off the back of the Euros, coming back off the Champions League where he hurt his face as well. And KDB for the first 3 months of the season was really poor.
Yeah.
But Salah was really good. So then when you flip it for the second half.
True, I guess, yeah.
You see, it's very hard to remember everything because most people probably forgot that the Euros were last year.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, here we are. It was on Friday night, but Edin Terzic and Dortmund can thank Youssoufa Moukoko.
Yeah, incredible impact off the bench, Nathan. They were 1-0 down against Freiburg, and to be fair, struggling. And Terzic through Moukoko, who's 17 years old, him and Bino Gittens as well, the former Manchester City player, who both had an incredible impact. Moukoko with a goal and two assists. Bino Gittens with a goal and an assist as well to turn the game around, really, to win 3-1. In the last 15 minutes, there was a big mistake by Fleck and the Freiburg goalkeeper on the first goal, to be fair, that really brought Dortmund back into it. Otherwise, I didn't see how they could go and win that game. They were very average. But that first goal, the equalizer with the goalkeeper mistake, made a big difference. And then after that, Moukoko, Bino Gittens, all that youth really changed the game. And it was good to see. I don't know if they can have that kind of, you know, do it consistently over the whole 90 minutes. And maybe for them right now, they're 17 and 18, a role as a sort of an impact sub is better. Mm-hmm. But certainly they're very much inspired Dortmund, who needed that win to go 2-2. And for Terzic, she's good, but there's still a lot of work to be done because they were, for 70 minutes, they were not good, not good at all. Nathan, a lot of people don't care about the Ballon d'Or. I do, to be fair. But there's still a lot of people who are upset that Lionel Messi was not included in the 30-man nominees list.
Yeah, it's a sad time for all the Messi stands out
not
there.
Not in the 30, I know.
30 players
Come
have
on,
had a
Messi.
Better season than Lionel Messi. But, you know, he'll probably admit himself that last year was a down year for him.
It was difficult.
You expected him to do better this year because, you know, he's without a doubt one of the best, if not the best player in the world.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that he deserves to win a Ballon d'Or every year.
No, that's true.
But it's
that's
a sad time. It's a sad time.
It's just strange. For I think the first time since 2004.
It's the first time you and I have got something in common with Lionel Messi. We're all not involved in a conversation for Ballon d'Or.
I love that. I love that.
So, Jules, Lorient and Lyon was postponed yesterday for an interesting reason, was it not?
It was indeed, because Lorient, on their pitch in the stadium, had hosted a music festival for the last 5 days, which I'm not sure is the greatest of idea considering the season has started and there's a heat wave in France, like in pretty much of Europe. And that it was likely that all those fans on the pitch will damage the pitch. And indeed, the pitch is wrecked. Mm-hmm. I think Lyon saw a good opportunity then to have a weekend rest for their players and said, you know what, that game has to be postponed. Look at the pitch. It's risky for the players. They will get injured. Lyon were like, come on, let's come and play. Be fine. Lorient said that Lyon put pressure on the league to postpone the game, which they did eventually. So now there's a big fight between the two presidents, the Lorient one, Ferry, and Olas at Lyon. But yeah, the game was postponed because of a music festival, which has to be a first, really.
Yeah, that has to be. And I think the real conspiracy theory is when you say that, I think it was Lyon fans that were on the field for 5 days before the game.
Exactly.
Making sure the field wasn't ready.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Nathan, thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure.
I love having you here with me on the show. We'll be back on Thursday with another Gab and Jules show. Make sure you join us then. And as Gab always say, love
yourself.
love your neighbor. Love football.